Hey, welcome to the Lament Configuration Podcast, the podcast where we talk about shit that makes us sad, or mad, or horny, or just stuff that we want to talk about with each other that you get to listen to. I'm Julia Graffaire. I'm a graphic novelist, and with me is my friend Gretchen.
Hi, I am Gretchen Felker-Martin, horror author and film critic.
Yay.
And we were thinking that tonight, you know, we've talked a lot on this podcast about, like, the fallacy of waiting for confidence to come over you and how it's sort of just like a trick you play on yourself until it's real.
That's right. We were talking about fake it till you make it.
Right. Yeah. We were trying to remember before we started recording what it was we'd been talking about last week.
It's so long ago.
I mean, it might as well not have happened for all that I remember about it.
Also, my microphone was fucked up last week and it was like painful for me to listen to. I'm so sorry to all the listeners who had to suffer through it.
It was just a little crunchy.
To me, it's terrible. It's the worst thing that could ever happen. My week was ruined.
You have the ears of like a delicate forest nymph.
Yeah, I'm like a delicate forest nymph. Exactly.
One of those. That's such a great metaphor, Julia. I really wish I'd come up with it.
Thanks. I just thought of it now.
Wow.
You know what you should have said? I'm a Twitter guy now. I'm going to tell you the joke you should have made, which is the joke that you actually made, but worse.
Wow.
That's so powerful. So after we had the conversation about faking it until you make it, we had a conversation in private about kind of the converse of that, which is talking yourself down. This is like endemic among young artists, I think, I don't even know if young is the right word. People of all ages lack confidence.
Right. There's an emotional youngness to it, certainly.
It is, because it's asking a lot of the people around you. And I guess I just wanted to get on here and beg everybody to knock it off. When you like, everybody knows that you can't go posting a thing that you did and be like, so I did a thing. Like, it's that fake sounding modesty. It's kind of obnoxious.
Right.
Self-promotion always feels bad. Yes. And so there's like an instinct to be like, hi, I'm sorry for showing you this. Mm-hmm. And what you think you're doing is letting people know that you know it's dumb so that then they can't make fun of you or be mad at you for doing something dumb.
It's like walking up to a knife fight and stabbing yourself in the stomach immediately and being like, fuck you. I can't lose. I'm already dead.
Well, I know you want to stab me, so let me just take care of this for you. But what you're actually doing is setting your audience's expectations very low. Right. It's insulting. It's insulting to the people who like your work.
It is. It is when saying you have bad taste if you like this.
You're an idiot for giving me your money and following me, and I think less of you. I wouldn't do it.
It's not that you can't feel these things. These are normal human emotions.
Oh, yeah. Everybody feels like that. You just can't go around saying it.
Right. Because when you do that, it's like outsourcing the emotional work of talking back to yourself.
Yeah. Because then the people that you're talking to are in the position of being forced to be like, no, it's okay. It's fine. It's actually really good. You're asking them to do that work. It's called fishing for compliments. It feels like that's not what you're doing, but it's what you're doing. You know, I do a lot of like gaming out conversations and like, here's what I'm going to say and here's how the other person is going to feel if I say that to them. It comes from growing up around really passive aggressive people, I think. Mm-hmm. So I tend to think a lot about like, how is this going to come across? How are people going to feel if I say this to them? And when you say like, oh, I'm sorry, this sucks, people, whether they think it sucks or not, are going to feel obliged to be like, no, it doesn't. It's okay. Like, right, you are forcing them into that position. You really are, because there's nothing else that they can say.
Right. There's a social expectation in American culture that if someone talks themselves down publicly, you have to argue. Yeah. You know, I know that norm is different in other places, but that's what it is here. And I just can't tell you how draining and tedious it is to encounter this viewpoint over and over and over again.
Bad. It's tiring to be around people who do it.
Yes, it is. It is, because it's like their organs are outside their bodies.
And not in a sexy way like Julia from Hellraiser.
Right. There's nothing hot about it.
Right.
Unlike most gore.
Part of the reason for pretending to be confident when you're not is that it makes other people more comfortable.
Yes.
Okay. So my interest in this also goes back to Miss Manners, Judith Martin, who's a mm-hmm. big influence on me. And if you're not familiar with her work, you probably are imagining something extremely shitty and square, which in some ways it is. But Judith Martin, is her writing tends to be very dry. It's subtle. She'll explain a principle to you in a way that lets you know what she thinks of it without coming out and saying it. And her approach to etiquette is that we follow certain social norms because they allow the people around us to feel comfortable. And the ultimate goal of etiquette is not to force everybody to conform to these norms, but it's to make sure that everybody feels comfortable. So part of that maintaining etiquette means not just blurting out exactly what's on your mind, because it makes other people uncomfortable. It makes it difficult to be around you.
Yes. I'll just get out ahead of any possible. I'm going to game this conversation with our audience for a second. We would not and do not want to lecture anyone who has a different set of abilities or social skills than we do.
I do.
Well, I know, honey.
No, you're right. I don't. It's fine. It's fine.
You know, this is not intended to be like a guide to how to behave. We're just telling you that a certain set of behaviors sucks ass and we hate it. I think that it's a very achievable goal for just about anyone to stop saying things like, I'm so pathetic, I'm terrible, nobody loves me, my art is awful, in a public arena.
Yeah, you can say it to your friends.
You can
say it to people that you go to for emotional support.
I mean, you and I do this all the time.
Like, yeah. We'll be like, I'm feeling terrible about this work that I'm doing. It's so stupid. Is it pointless? And then, you know, the other one will be like, actually, it's really good. And here's something that I like about it. And like, that's what you do for a friend.
Right.
Something to me because I value your opinion.
Right. And like, because we know each other.
Yeah. And because you don't think less of me.
No, never.
One of the examples that I came up with when we were talking about this in our conversation that nobody else heard was when you have something really bad happen to you, like if there's a death in your family, you know, like your house burns down, you get a divorce, something like that, people don't want to be around you. Like, it sucks. It's frankly horrifying to see. Like, if you talk about it at work, people at work will start to think that there's something wrong with you. People draw away from you. It's a weird, horrible instinct.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's like not wanting to get pulled under by someone who's drowning.
Yeah, it's exactly like that. And there's a desire, I think, to find a way to tell themselves that can't happen to them.
Right, as though it were contagious or something.
So then they have to locate the problem with you. It's because you're a bad person somehow, so they don't want to be around you. And sometimes in life, it is inevitable that that will happen, but you don't need to make it happen.
No, you don't. It doesn't need to be fed.
You don't need to go around like reminding people that you're here to ruin things.
Here I am to make your day worse and make you sad and just put a bunch of terrible feelings in your head. Don't I suck?
Yes. Yeah, you're right. It's mean to be like, you have to stop acting in the way that feels natural to you. But I mean, you do. You just do. Well, people are not naturally presentable.
No, not at all.
There's a reason that we all make an effort not to shit our pants, though we are
right.
Inclined to do that from birth.
A personal example. When you and I met, I was like in a really bad mental health place.
Mm-hmm.
And I would break down a lot more frequently. And like require a lot more emotional maintenance than I do now. And I think that if that had continued, we would probably have a very different relationship because I would like be more of a drain to be around. And those are not like nice things to think about, but life is not fair.
I mean, it's, I think the feeling is mutual that like, I find it easier to be around you because you value yourself. Like,
that's right.
You know that you're good at what you do.
Right. I have successfully grown the limb of confidence.
The secret eighth limb.
Just sort of a nubby little tentacle under my left hip.
Oh, is that where yours is?
Yeah.
It's your witch mark.
Yeah. And you know, it can give me some support, which is nice.
Mm.
Yeah.
Which one is the left one? Is that Terror or Erebus?
That's Terror. Which, although it is not the better icebreaker, is undamaged and thus leads.
Nice.
Yeah.
Mine are Magenta and Columbia.
Those are such good tit names.
I know.
You're so smart.
Thanks. That's very old. I think I gave them those names when I was like 20.
My tits are very new, comparatively.
And I think I named my cunt Genevieve, which means white wave.
Beautiful.
Thank you.
Sounds like what Jean-Luc Picard would name his catamaran.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, just saying, Patrick Stewart, if you're listening.
Call me. I don't know. Can Patrick Stewart still get it? He's like really old.
Yeah, but you know what? He's also very nice and has great principles.
He seems cool.
Yeah, I think
so. Yeah, he could still get it.
Yeah.
It's weird. I'm not like a huge like daddy person. It's not like a requirement for me to be attracted to somebody that they be daddy. Mm-hmm. But like, I definitely have had a crush on Picard from since when the show was airing and I was like 8, which is weird. I mean, I don't know if I would have exactly, I wouldn't have called it a crush then. Like, I wasn't masturbating thinking about him. Mm-hmm. But it's definitely like a formative influence where like looking back on it, I'm like, this is an example of like a man that represented to me like the kind of man that I would want, you know?
Yeah. And
I envisioned my adult self with someone like him, partly, you know, probably because I really identified with Dr. Crusher. Because back then you didn't see a lot of redheads on TV.
That's very true. And she's
especially not if they were like, when you do see them, they tend to be like a sex symbol. It's like, right. You get Jessica Rabbit.
She's more no nonsense and highly intellectual. And it's funny. As an adult, I would say that you're quite a bit like Picard.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
I'm a gentleman and a scholar.
You are. You know so much about so many varied subjects. Philosophy is very important to you. You are
very principled, I think.
Yes, you are extremely principled. And you are very willing to consider the viewpoints of others, even when they are foreign to you.
I have a tendency to wrap up a conversation with a little speech. About, you know, humanity and principles and things.
You also drink a lot of tea?
A lot of tea. I do. I love Earl Grey tea. Not just because of him, but probably partly because of him. That's such an early influence on me that it is difficult to say who I would be if I had never watched Star Trek The Next Generation.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But it's so, like, thinking about Dr. Crusher or Picard as a sex symbol, all the characters on Star Trek The Next Generation, and maybe other Star Treks that I'm less familiar with, they're part of the fantasy of Star Trek is that there's all these highly competent people that are working together as a team. They respect each other's strengths. They're also friends, but they like have managed to have emotional relationships that don't interfere with their work relationships or that support their work relationships. And they also just like are all having casual sex like all the time in a way that I just assumed that adults would be doing when I grew up. I grew up very chill about sex. Like, it wasn't until I was in my early 20s probably that I realized that like most people are not not like yeah. That.
I was raised by very religious parents. And so I was a very outwardly uptight child and teen, although I fucked around a lot and felt very bad about it.
I mean, I was like not I wasn't a prude and I wasn't promiscuous. Like, it just wasn't a field on which I felt I had to prove anything. Mm-hmm. And that's still kind of my attitude, that is just like another area of human interaction.
That's exactly how I've come to feel about sex, is that it's just not special in the way that our culture demands you consider it to be.
Yeah,
special.
It's like a type of conversation.
Right. Sex is no more mystical than eating or talking or going to the bathroom. Like, it's just a thing people do.
Like, when I am trying to get perspective about when there's discourse about sex and it's like obvious to me that everybody else is wrong, going back to eating is something that's like a touchstone for me, because I'm like, you know, sometimes you want to show people eating. Like, is it necessary? Is it interesting? It depends. Sometimes, yes. Is it character development? Sure. Are there meals that are meaningless and boring? Yes. Are there meals that mean the world? Absolutely.
Right. You know, you think about something like The Cook, The Thief, His Wife, and Her Lover. All of the eating in that film informs those
literally
characters so fucking deeply. Like, there's not a wasted bite in that whole movie.
That movie is so fucking good. That really goes hard.
I love that movie.
I think it is more of a Gretchen movie than a Julia movie, but it's one of the ones that is like at the intersection.
Yeah, there's a big area of overlap.
Because your area of movie is like, as you said before, abrasive.
Right. Was it me
that told you that the movies you like are abrasive?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I like The Devils. I like Possession. I like movies with like really discordant soundtracks and a lot of offensive, difficult things going on at a really high
volume. But also like really aesthetic. Like, yeah. You don't mind if it's stylized.
No, not at all. I love that.
I think, yeah, you prefer it. Whereas for me, like, I think that I like a little more realism in my movies that I love. Like, if it's really highly stylized, that can be a turnoff to me. Mm-hmm. I really dislike bright colors most of the time.
Yeah.
And I like a very slow movie. I love dialogue, but I don't want unnecessary dialogue or like unnecessarily witty dialogue. God.
Right. Or like
I like ambient dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And I like a lot of long takes. I like a lot of scenes of people just doing things that they do. You know, for me, it's like The Revenant or In the Realm of the Senses, or like, you know, just make it sensual but boring. That's what I like.
When I think about like the visual quality that I see you react positively to, what comes to mind is like PBS nature documentaries and stuff when I was growing up. And I mean that as a compliment. I love those.
No, I know.
But it's,
I mean, I'm not offended.
It's this sort of earthy, realist sense of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Someone who has their hands in the dirt.
The Cook, The Thief, His Wife, and Her Lover is like, it is pretty highly stylized, but it's also very sensual. It's very physical. Mm-hmm. Like, it's so dirty.
Yeah.
The sex, I mean, it's in some ways the sex is idealized, but it also like feels really human. You know, like the four tarot suits, right?
Yeah.
That correspond to the four like astrological elements. And the pentacle corresponds to Earth, where like it's all about the material realm, material acquisition, fecundity. There's a focus on sensuality as a way to access the divine, right? Like the connection that they have is not because they are having like amazing conversations. It's sensual. It's primarily sensual.
Right. You see them sharing the same pleasures and connecting over that even before they've spoken.
Yes.
The titular cook brings them both a dish that he knows that they will appreciate because they have refined palates.
Mm. To be singled out as someone with a refined palate.
Yeah, that's the good stuff. Just give me that A in therapy, the thing it's both possible to get and normal to want.
Give me that fucking on a butcher's block in front of a severed pig's head.
All that stuff is so incredibly hot to me.
And they just, like, they don't just do it once. They, like, have sex in all the different rooms with all the different types of foods.
Right. The plucked birds and the bread and the cheeses. And whew. It's so incredibly beautiful. And it does. It puts sex on this continuum with, like, other foundational human modes of interaction. And eating is, of course, a mode of interaction because our meals as a species have almost always been communal.
Mm-hmm. And these are base sensual pleasures, like, mm-hmm. and I think the thief, her husband, like, to some extent represents that, like, how it can be degrading and false. Like, you can love good food and still be a prick. You can love transgressive sex and be a prick.
Yes.
Or it can be an access point to something transcendental. It's still the same realm of the senses.
Right. The moral axis comes from the individuals involved and their choices and inclinations. And the acts themselves have no moral dimension.
Yeah.
It's experience. It's sensuality.
We're not St. Augustine over here. Like, you don't have to renounce sensual pleasures in order to be, like, a deep person.
Right.
Or to be enlightened.
I would say
you have to embrace those things to be enlightened.
I would say that those things are actually essential experiences in order to be meaningfully connected to people around you.
You're going to be so shocked to hear this, but I agree completely. Wow.
Wow.
The exact wow that we do when we say something to the cat. David, you're so handsome. Wow. You want to answer some questions?
Yeah, that sounds really good. Let me pull them up. All right. This one is from Where Did Jenny Go? Hey, Jenny. Jenny's our
Jenny!
Baby.
That wasn't a Forrest Gump reference. God forbid. I'm just saying Jenny because I like you.
Yeah. The two of you talk about having the discipline to get the work done. Even when you don't want to, you're having a really tough time. Can artistic discipline be developed? Yes.
Hell yeah. Okay. I saw this question on Twitter, so I have thoughts that I formulated. So to me, there are two stages to the artistic process. You know, just like there's two stages in getting a rocket to launch or whatever. There's the inspiration. Sometimes you have an idea and it's so hot to you and you just can't stop thinking about it. And you just have to make this thing. Like, somebody has to make this thing. It has to exist in the real world. And that's like 2%. Of the process. And then the rest of it is just keep making the lines on the paper, right? That's me as a visual artist. That's what I have to do.
I mean, I also make lines on paper.
No, you don't. Just, you type.
They're just letters.
Sometimes you are holding a little fireball in your hands and it's so hot. The rest of the time, you're just documenting that.
Right. You gotta pull a Boy
Scout. I mean,
Scout.
You go to work every day, right? Yeah. People do that. You just, like, you wake up, you don't feel like going to work, and you still go.
Yeah, I mean, you and I are both professional artists, and I know for a fact that we often have days where we would really rather not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a matter of habit, motivation, normalization. If you do something enough, if you put enough time and sort of sense of importance into your art practice, then it becomes normal. Mm-hmm. And it becomes easier to just sort of pick it up at will.
This is like another thing about pretending to yourself. Just tell yourself it's a job. It is a job. Mm-hmm. And in an art job, in a creative job, a lot of times you put in the hours and they yield nothing. Mm-hmm. Most of the hours that you put in will yield not very much, but you have to be there. It's hard for me to describe the process in a way that doesn't sound mystical, but this is the closest thing that I have to a spirituality, so indulge me. There is a spirit that moves through you when you have inspiration, and you have to be present to receive it. So you have to be there with your hands in the materials and your skills on point in order to become the transceiver for the thing.
You and I talk pretty frequently about art as an experience that exists sort of between people. Like, mm-hmm. an artist creates something, their audience encounters it outside the artist's body, and it's fully in neither of them, but they connect through it. Mm-hmm. And in a lot of ways, I think the process is the same, because I agree with you. There is this force that comes into you and creates this incredible urge to make something. If you don't have both the formed habit and the ability to do that, it will inevitably peter out and splatter all over the page, and you'll get nothing. You'll, you know, restart the same project 50 times. And there's no magical workaround to it. Like, the fact that it is this sort of spiritual experience does not diminish the fact that it is also hard work and nothing but.
So there's this Martha Graham quote that I think sums it up. And I looked it up and I'm going to read it to you. There's a vitality, a life force, an energy, a quickening that is translated through you into action. And because there is only one of you in all of time, this expression is unique. And if you block it, it will never exist through any other medium and it will be lost. The world will not have it. It is not your business to determine how good it is, nor how valuable, nor how it compares with other expressions. It is your business to keep it yours, clearly and directly, to keep the channel open. You do not even have to believe in yourself or your work. You have to keep yourself open and aware to the urges that motivate you. Keep the channel open.
Yeah, that's it in a nutshell.
The way that you keep the channel open as an artist is that you stay in practice.
Yeah, every day.
You have to keep yourself limber for when it happens, when it wants to come to you. So that means you have to do it every day or as many days as you can.
I will sometimes take the weekend or part of the weekend, but even then, usually I wind up scribbling something down. Mm-hmm. But weekdays, I try to get 500 words a day done.
And that's badass.
Mostly I do it. And the result is that, you know, I get like a book a year out of that.
What is Bendrix's work schedule?
I believe
it's, I always refer back to that. Does he do 1,000 words a day?
I think he does 500 as well.
He does, yeah. He does 500 a day and he gets a book a year.
Yep.
There you go. You and Morris Bendrix.
Yeah. Love to be in that company.
I love him. I love him.
I know you do. And he's, you know, he's a great character. I would hate to be around him.
Yeah.
Next question?
You don't want to talk about Morris Bendrix more? Okay.
I'm always down to talk about the end of the affair. Love it when the affair just ends.
Gretchen watching both movies with me. That's the end of the affair.
God, those movies both sucked in completely distinct ways.
No, the old one sucked in like a just profound, unrecoverable way. The 1998 one like overshoots, and I respect that.
Yeah.
I was also very drunk by the time that we got to the end of it.
Yeah, you were very like at both of them, as I recall.
Yeah, because the next day I was like, wait a minute. Co-husbands? And you were like, no, yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, definitely the there's so much more to like in the newer one, but it's just like it has fault lines that cannot be overcome.
Yeah.
Maybe the reason I shy away from being compared to Bendrix is that in my work habits and the ease with which I get bored and how sometimes I can have like a very contrary reaction to someone else's strong emotions or opinion, I feel a little too much like him. It's a little too close to home.
That's part of the pain of the end of the affair, is that you are forced to identify with Bendrix, who sucks.
Such an asshole.
He's unable to be sexually attracted to people that he thinks might be better than him.
Ugh.
God bless.
Yeah. A real hero and a real human being.
All right. Someday they'll make a great movie of the end of the affair.
I bet they will. I bet it'll be in like 20 years.
I bet I'll be dead.
You will not be dead in 20 years. We'll go see it and get drunk in the theater and your children will be very embarrassed. All right. This one comes from KG Taverty. I know you, Gretchen, hate superheroes for obvious reasons, but that makes me curious about how you feel about media that subverts the trope and makes the superheroes either villains or just extremely incompetent. Still the same visceral hatred? I suspect yes, but I'm curious. Yeah, you guess right. I like Alan Moore's Watchmen. I think that is a bullet in the head of a very insubstantial genre.
I like it, but I don't love it. Like, it doesn't mean anything to me.
Right. Like, in some ways, it was the first piece of superhero media that I ever read because I was very uninterested in them as children. And it is an effective cap on the entire experiment. So going back to, like, other books where the superheroes are just one-dimensional, trite people, there's nothing left in it for me. It's so tapped out. And I just, at a basic level, I'm extremely disinterested in a story about, like, what if a cop was really strong?
Here's the thing. Like, when people are posing the question, like, oh, well, I heard that comics are not for kids anymore. Recommend a grown-up comic to me that might be serious literature. A lot of people jump right to Watchmen. And the thing is that Watchmen doesn't mean anything if you don't give a fuck about superheroes. It's still boring. It's better, but it is a deconstruction of a trope that is meaningless to you.
Yes. Like, which is why I don't go back to Watchmen the same way that I go back to, like, From Hell.
Yeah. Are there other deconstructions of superhero tropes? There's probably, like, superhero movies that pat themselves on the back for, you know, being like a smart superhero movie that
there definitely are
winks, you know, at the audience or whatever. Like, fucking eat me. Like, I don't care.
It's just nothing to me. I remember there was actually a wave of them in the mid-aughts. There was this big Will Smith movie called Hitchcock where it's like, well, he's Superman, but he's like a deadbeat piece of shit.
What?
And I watched it years after it came out at the home of someone I didn't particularly care for. And it sucks. It's just not an interesting question to pose. I don't care about people whose primary relationship to the world is like solving crimes. That's fucking just, it means nothing to me. I don't give a shit.
Yeah, like, here's the thing. Crimes are good.
Yeah, crimes are good. And honestly, I cannot think of a bank robber that I wouldn't want to get away with it.
Some crimes are bad, but the crimes that are the most bad are the ones that cops give a shit about the least.
Right. You know, like the economic, like, exploitation of everyone.
White collar crime.
And even
day traders are robbing people blind.
Yeah, the worst crimes are perfectly legal. And
they'll put somebody who steals food stamps in jail.
Yeah, the worst crimes are perfectly legal.
I mean, this is a very facile analysis, but like, the
thank you.
Superman is, I don't know what Superman does. Batman is beating up bank robbers. Like, yeah, fuck banks.
Yeah,
fucking parasites.
Superheroes are all like status quo maintenance machines. And I know that there are many superhero arcs where writers attempt to take these things to task, but I've never read one that was even remotely interesting to me.
I mean, I think maybe they're like starting to try and have fun with it where like the Joker is cool now, or I don't watch those movies. I don't.
It's so fucking boring, Julia.
I mean, it's like, I don't care about the thing, and therefore I don't care about the deconstruction of the thing either.
Right. The last time that I went to see one of those movies, I fell asleep in the theater. And that's the only time in my life that I've fallen asleep during a movie.
Oh, I've fallen asleep during a lot of movies.
Well, I know. You're a sleepy little baby.
Shut up. You know, it's like if I tell you that I heard a joke in Lithuanian and I didn't laugh, then like, is the deconstruction of the Lithuanian joke going to mean anything to me? Also, no.
Right.
I'm not there. I'm not with you in any of this journey.
Right. The closest analogy I can think of for myself is like self-aware commercials.
Ugh. Oof.
Fuck it. I hate that worse.
It's awful.
Do not pretend to be my friend. You are trying to sell me something. I know it. You can.
Can you believe we're doing a commercial about this?
Shut the fuck up. I'll kill you.
Yes.
Yes. I. Nothing is more believable than the fact that some asshole would want to sell something to me.
Mm-hmm. Don't you, when you look at like an old publication, you get nostalgic for, I mean, not nostalgic because it's not like we remember these days, but when there was ads in magazines that were just like, Ocean Breeze soap will get you clean. It's the most cleanest soap.
Yep.
Out of 10 people find themselves cleaner after using, like, tell me the facts about the soap.
I think that's around the time that you were born, shortly before I was born, advertisements had already like moved into weird euphemistic territory.
Yeah.
You know, like there are those L'Oreal commercials about how their soap makes you smell like a sexy, hot, dirty baby.
Oh, God, like the Love's Baby Soft ads.
Yes, that's it. They're so creepy.
Yeah, where there's like a model in like a weird baby doll underwear with like a lollipop, and it's like
a baby who grew up very sexy. It's just
they wouldn't run those ads now, but it's not because they know that it's tasteless. It's because they know that consumers won't stand for it. And they've found some other more tasteless thing to do.
Right. I mean, the last time that I saw advertisements in the wild, I was in the waiting room at a doctor's office and they had a television. You know, of course, car commercials are the same eternally. I would love to talk to someone who is influenced to a purchase by a car commercial. That would be a fascinating experience for me.
I mean, who are these people who even get to choose what cars they have? I don't know if you have ever owned a car, actually.
No, I never have.
I never owned a car until I moved back to New Hampshire to care for my mom when she was ill. And I lived in a community where you really couldn't do anything except if you drove places. I mean, you know where I lived in Concord. Like, you can't walk to the grocery store, which is what I would have done any other place that I had lived in my entire life. And, you know, my whole family was like, when are you going to be a real grown-up that owns a car? Anyway, so I was like 32 or something and buying my first car. And it turns out that you don't get to pick, like, the car that you can afford that is available at the time when you need a car that also works. That's the car that you get. You don't get to choose. You really don't. So who are these people who are picking what car they get?
I mean, it's not
based on a commercial.
We have nothing.
No. Yeah. So I'm curious about those people.
Me too. I feel like it would be an interesting anthropology exercise. But anyway,
I bet we'd hate them.
Yes, absolutely. There's no way. Even if they were perfectly nice, we would fucking despise them.
Mm-hmm. I despise them right now, just preemptively.
We've successfully invented a type of guy and gotten mad at him.
Yes! You had another viral tweet this week.
Oh, Christ.
You gotta stop.
I know. It started to do numbers and I was just like, this is terrible. I hate this. I hate that.
What was it about? Was it about gay haircuts? That's the discourse I remember from this week.
Oh, no. It was, I'm gonna look it up, but let's talk while I do.
Gay haircuts discourse.
Gay haircuts discourse. That was a terrible discourse.
It was a terrible discourse. I have never been treated as not queer enough to be in a queer space. And it's not because I'm super queer. I'm just not there to get my identity validated.
Right. And I think that you have a very integrated sense of self as a an adult.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not something that you reactively internalize anything that might touch on it about.
Yeah, I don't tend to like panic if I think that there's a thing about me that people are not seeing.
Yeah, I don't give a shit.
That's like a part of my identity. I don't know. But I'm also like, I go down easy. Like, there's a lot of things about me that make me like unremarkable.
Right. Like, you're a beautiful cis woman.
Thank you. And
you're welcome.
I mean, yeah, like, I'm pretty and I'm white and I'm thin and I'm like, you know, people are not necessarily thrilled to have me, but they're not like noticing me to the point where like, oh, well, this is ruining everything for her to be here.
Right. There's not going to be some knee jerk response to you.
It's like, it's fine. I get away with that.
Yeah. I think that like some people are really looking to be invalidated in a way.
I mean, yeah, like if there's stuff that you're insecure about, then you're really sensitive to anything that indicates that people are confirming your insecurity.
Right. And the more that you react defensively to that, the more entrenched you become in this sort of like persecution mindset about it.
Mm-hmm. My thing that it's like that a lot of times, I think, aside from my job, because when I'm meeting like Frank's classmates' parents, like it's hard for them to understand the work that I do. But also, I'm in a long-term partnership now, but not with my son's biological father. And sometimes I do feel like self-conscious about being a single mother. And like, I'll be in situations where like everybody is parents, like a birthday party or whatever. And I'm like, oh, they all think there's something wrong with me.
Yeah.
And like all my stereotypes about like single mothers, like whatever kind of cultural detritus I've picked up, I'm like assuming that people are looking at me and thinking that. Like you can't not. Because again, it's like we were talking about earlier, like you think that you're going to like preemptively know the bad things that people are thinking about you and that's going to protect you somehow.
Right. I'm intimately familiar with this.
Yeah. Let me explain it to you, Gretchen.
No, but being a single mother is like an extremely big axis of discrimination in our society.
Yeah. And it is something that I probably get away with much more easily because I live like kind of a bohemian lifestyle. Like there's a much higher bar to clear to be like weird and gross in my social circle.
Yes.
Like the weirdest thing about me is that I'm in a long-term partnership with children.
That's very true.
Like that's the thing that I'm embarrassed about the most when I'm like hanging out with people. I'm like, look, I'm sorry. Like,
yeah, you know, Julia, it's fine. It's fine that you're in this straight relationship. But you wouldn't force it into our faces.
I'm not judging you about it, but just like it makes people uncomfortable when you bring it up.
Yeah, that was a terrible discourse. I found my tweet that went viral.
Tell me about your viral tweet.
And it was my saying that Darren Aronofsky and Christopher Nolan have made careers out of stealing from Satoshi Kon.
Oh, we got some really lousy people in this outfit. I wouldn't trust a fucking one of them.
Yeah, that's exactly how I feel. Which prompted some of the worst replies I've ever had until this tweet, thank God, did not go nearly as wide. But there was this guy yesterday on Twitter who was like, I'm very disappointed that the new Mortal Kombat movie is less than 2 hours long.
Oh, I love the Mortal Kombat man.
I don't think this gives them adequate time to like set up all of the characters and rich backstory. And I tweeted like, what in God's name about Mortal Kombat could take more than 2 hours to explain? Like,
you fucking snob.
If you can't make a movie about a guy saying, come over here and then ripping out a dude's spine in under 2 hours, you shouldn't make a movie.
Aren't you curious what the Mortal Kombat lore is? I'm curious now. I really am. Not enough to look it up, but I'm thinking about it.
I did look it up because I had this really obnoxious guy in my mentions who like got really angry that I said that Mortal Kombat wasn't Barry Lyndon, you know, which is the Cooper film. Which I think is probably one of the least controversial things I have ever said. Mortal Kombat is definitely not Barry Lyndon.
All of Mortal Kombat is lit by candlelight.
And of course, you view all the arenas from over a stone wall. Well, mm-hmm. Guy narrates dryly.
I'm going to tell you what I think the Mortal Kombat lore is.
Okay.
Okay. I think it is that there's like a hell dimension where all the greatest like fighters from the multiverse have to go and engage in like the ultimate tournament.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty much it from what I understand.
But like, why? Like, I feel, okay, there's Matt Groening did like a bunch of life and hell strips that are about like his kids. And they're very funny. And there's one where one of his kids is asking, why do people go to Dracula's house? And he's like, well, you know, because he invited them. And he's like, but why do they go? Which is a good question.
It is a good question.
And that's my question about Mortal Kombat. Like, okay, there's a great tournament. It's in the Hell Dimension. You could win respect from men with four arms. But like, why do they go?
I mean, the classic answer is because there wouldn't be a story if they didn't.
Yeah, you're right. Hoisted by my own petard.
I told you, you shouldn't keep it out like that.
God.
Julia, I'm sorry, but if you're going to have a petard, we've talked about this, you've got to clean it and keep it in its case.
Gretchen just ripping my spine out.
Yeah, I went and looked up some lore from one of the more recent Mortal Kombat games, and it's functionally indistinguishable from a Marvel movie. It's go here, get this crystal, go back, close the...
Ooh, there's a crystal?
Black skulls. Like, it's just, it's tedious, nothing fetch quest shit.
What do they get if they win?
I don't fucking know.
You read the thing. Yeah, well, look it up.
I didn't read the whole thing. I read the first paragraph.
They get, you look it up. I'm going to come up with something. They get, there's a hell dimension and, all the worlds will be like enslaved by the evil god emperor unless somebody wins the Mortal Kombats, and their final battle is the guy who wins all of the combats gets to battle the god emperor and win the freedom of all the worlds. That's what I think it is.
This information does not appear to be readily accessible.
Wow. Are we going to have to play the Mortal Kombat games in order to find out?
Oh, Christ, I hope not.
I bet they're fun.
Well, yeah, sure. That's true. I like ripping a guy's skull out of his head as much as the next girl.
Who doesn't?
Maybe even more.
Probably more.
Yeah. But, I mean, this is such a boring phenomenon of people who really associate very personally to the things that they like.
I would never do that.
So that if someone says this isn't serious, they have to have a whole thing about it. And they have to defend it as though it's fucking Ulysses or something.
I like to think that I'm able to keep the things that I care about in perspective.
I think you do.
Well, of course you do, because you have the same values that I do.
I just mean that, like, you know, there are things that you and I connect to with different levels of intensity in art. And it's, like, never been an issue.
You mean different levels between you and me?
Yeah.
Okay. You know, like the devils?
Right. Like I'm more into the devils than you are. Or like we both have like an emotional connection to his dark materials, but you're more interested in it than I am.
That's true.
It's just like, you know, none of that stuff has ever caused like a conflict between us.
Yeah. I mean, it's like degrees of personal preference. Like you wear a different color of lipstick than I do too. Like,
right. It's really sort of nothing to do with who we are or our relationship to one another.
Yeah, I'm not going to go argue with you about how actually this is the best lip color.
Right. Okay, I have no idea. I've been like scanning Wikipedia for minutes now. I have absolutely no clue what you get for
winning. We've been bested by it.
Yeah, I've been fatality'd by the Mortal Kombat wiki page.
Mortally combated. Listeners, write in, explain Mortal Kombat to us in what is the maximum length of a tweet now? 244 characters?
280 characters.
280 characters or less. Because if you do multi-tweets, I will not read them.
No, God, no.
Absolutely not. Unless we're actually friends, where like I know your name and your face, I'm not going to read more than one tweet. If it's like /?, if it's /anything, I'm not going to do it. I'll read the first one and then I'll move on. I will probably mute you if you do a multi-tweet at me. It's that tedious. Don't do them to people. Nobody gives a shit. Shut the fuck up.
Do you have some feelings about this, Julia?
No.
Yeah, that's what I thought. What do you think? One more question?
Yeah.
All right. This one comes from Wrong Number Only. Nice and straightforward. What's the best mainstream horror film?
What is mainstream? All horror films are a little gauche, right?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know if there is a really truly mainstream horror film.
But I guess in terms of like things that are box office successes versus things that aren't.
Hellraiser? Nightmare on Elm Street?
Bram Stoker's Dracula?
Was that a box office success?
I'm pretty sure. Let me find out. It was like a big movie that year.
What was that, 1992? Shit was cool then.
Yeah.
In some ways.
Shit was cool in some ways.
Really insightful.
Yeah, we're very smart. It was a pretty good performer. Nothing special, but definitely a success. So yeah, I guess probably for me, either Hellraiser or Bram Stoker's Dracula. I think Bram Stoker's Dracula is closer to like who I am as a person, which is maximalist and gross.
I can't think of any other horror movies. The Thing was popular, wasn't it?
Oh yeah, usually.
Is They Live a horror film?
I would say so.
I don't know. Like, I don't really remember back then very well. So it's hard for me to say, like, there's probably a lot of stuff that I think is a big deal that is actually a cult classic.
Yeah. I mean, neither of us is a person who's terribly concerned with, like, how to codify a movie in, like, cultural or economic terms.
I cannot express how not aware of it I am.
I usually don't even give a shit about what genre something is. So yeah, Dracula and
Hellraiser, Nightmare on Elm Street.
Nightmare on Elm Street.
Like, I think Nightmare on Elm Street is pretty mainstream, actually.
That's true. Those slasher franchises.
There were, like, I remember when I was a kid, other kids dressing up as Freddy for Halloween.
When it comes to, like, that stripe of horror, Nightmare on Elm Street is definitely the best. It has better effects, it has a better monster, it has a better premise, and it has far and away the best violence.
Poltergeist is pretty good.
Ooh, I love Poltergeist. The effects in that movie are so cool.
Yeah.
The giant skull coming out of the closet and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Good shit.
All right, you want to call it a night?
Yeah, yeah, that sounds good to me.
I might come up with more to say about Poltergeist next week.
I'd be down for that.
All right, we got to get out of here. You've been listening to the Lament Configuration Podcast. You can find us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. You can find links to all the different things that you can find us on at anchor.fm/lament-configuration. Add us on Twitter with questions or explanations of Mortal Kombat lore. I'm at Thorazos, like Thorazine, if it was a planet.
And I'm at Scumbelievable. And really, please someone explain Mortal Kombat to us.
In a short tweet.
Just tell us what you win. What's
up? What's the prize of the combat? Why do they go?
The coolest guy? Because that sucks. That's not worth it. The trip alone. I mean,
it's important to be cool.
Well, yeah, but like trying to be cool is the least cool thing imaginable.
You're right. Killing people just because you want to be cool?
Lame.
It literally is Columbine shit. Fuck that. Good night, Gretchen. I love you.
Good night, Juge. I love you too.
Bye-bye.